dear to us, will be near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together, if the fates allow. There's the rub, isn't it? If the fates allow. What do you think's going to happen? Is it not seemingly true that everything appears to be the same, be it Christmas Day or Doomsday? Last night's wars are still raging this morning, and last week's criminality is still affecting every nation this morning, and last month's social lethargy is still plaguing us this morning, and last year's accumulated debts and doubts our fears are still weighing us down this morning. And what does faith have to do with it? Here we are expressing our faith on a Sunday morning. How does our daily run, our life in our common culture, connect with our faith, we may ask? What do the fates allow? Faith says God is love. Faith says Christ has redeemed the world. Faith says we are in the hands of a mighty spirit. Are these things right? What do you expect? Let me begin with the Matthew passage. To me, one of the most demanding portions in the New Testament. That is ministerial speak for I didn't like it. Our life response will directly influence the quality of our community and our personal and eternal destiny, says the parable. If you care for the least, the last, and the lost, God will bless you, says the parable. If you fail to care, God will condemn you. Our agreement or refusal, our direct action, is influential on the community in which we live and on our eternal destiny, says the parable. Does anyone believe that anymore? Is there really a primal force in life that leads to our blessing? Is there a chosen response in life that leads to our cursing? Does it really matter how we treat each other, or is personal vulnerability, one to the other, just a sign of weakness? Hold your guard up at all times. It's a tough world. We know that just below the surface, there is a whole other life going on. We read about it in the smutty sections of the newspaper and hear it filtering through the news on television. Dishonest and undesirable things are being done just under the surface of our culture everywhere. It's called corruption. And it happens in the heart and in business dealings and in governments around the world and in the minds of those who think of such things. It's a hidden world, but we know it is there, and we know it is doing harm. I often wonder if the living God deals with us at that world, at that level, underneath our Sunday and angelic smiles. Is God really seeing that and making judgments around us and in us out of that, do you think? The hidden world. I was hearing the other day on a podcast on CBC Radio when I was driving through town, the idea of an anonymous confession radio station where people can call in and make an anonymous confession of something terrible in their lives. And people were calling in and saying, well, I broke the law once, or I hurt somebody one time. One young woman called in and said, I was an escort for a year, years and years ago. I'm now happily married. My family doesn't know. It was an easy way to make money in university. And someone else phoned in confessing all kinds of sins and terrible. And I thought to myself two things. Why in the world would anybody phone? And the other is, what would I confess? And then I thought, don't go there, just keep driving the car. Underneath all the surface in which we live, there are other things going on. We know mixed moments and mixed motives in our own life story. These bleed into our common culture, and they weaken it, and they hurt the idea of goodness. My small slips and slides, the corners that I have cut, do damage to a seemingly sacred design which I sense in my best moments. And yet somewhere inside us, We also believe it's essential to help each other. There is a natural human kindness in each of us, and it comes out at the most interesting of moments. We feel empathy and pity for people. I slipped into a grocery store yesterday to pick up two or three convenience items, and there was obviously a street man there with a soiled coat and a long shaggy beard, and he was buying a small package of cold meats and a small bottle of something to drink. And as I went out of the store, I saw him standing beside the trash can where he was going to deposit the wrapper, and he was undoing the cap of something, and there he stood with the cold wind blowing down the street, and he ate a bite of his piece of cold meat and a sip of his drink, and for a brief moment my heart went out to him, and I thought, who are you? How did you get here? Where do you live? Well, I got in my car after that and drove away in my broken fashion, but for a moment, my heart was warm. We feel it is essential in us to protect the vulnerable and to punish the offender. That's very strong in the human personality. We carry a deep sense of right and wrong. We do. Even if we're doing wrong, we know we carry that deep sense of right and wrong, and we want to belong, and we want to be loved, and we want to be safe, and we want to thrive. It's in us all. Now, this Matthew text, which is so difficult to read and so difficult to hear, is a parable. And that's not to back away from its power in any way, but simply to tell you what it is. It's a parable. It's a story that has been made as a literary construct by somebody to teach us something. That's what a parable is. Now, whether it belongs to the lips of Jesus, or whether it comes from the community of faith who discerned who Jesus is and what he means, is an open question. But the challenge is clear. To be fully responsive to God, it says, we must step out of the easy, safe spaces beyond the fortresses of our life and go among the barbed wire and the snipers, for the purpose of human life together is to leave no one behind, no one behind. The piece begins with the phrase, when the Son of Man comes. Now that's a loaded phrase. It could have several meanings. One, it could have been used by Jesus simply to mean me. The Son of Man is me. The Son of Man is Jesus. It could also be a phrase used by those around Jesus to indicate the importance of his life in the mission of God, the Son of Man. This is a special person. It could also go even deeper into the heart of Judaism, in which the Son of Man there was a collective. The Son of Man is the whole tribe of people who finally saw the vision and got it right. The whole tribe of people who come striding into the world to awaken it to its goodness. When that Son of Man comes, the whole tribe getting it right, you know there are going to be changes made. The expectation of the Creator is that the Son of Man, the very best of us together, is going to awaken and is going to respond favorably to a noble life and is going to go about healing and helping those who are living at the frayed edges. That's the model in the parable. We cannot settle for criminality among us. We cannot say, oh, it's all right, it's just happening over there behind the fence and I don't have to look at it. We cannot settle for people being victimized. Well, I didn't know her anyway, and she probably had problems in her life anyway, and it didn't happen on my street, so it must be all right. And we cannot fear the mob to the point of being paralyzed and doing nothing against it. And we cannot condone the insidious nature of living half lives because they're being lived everywhere. When the Son of Man comes, the collective who finally understand and who finally get it right, the world will be changed, says the parable. Now, I need to see more of myself in this passage for sure, because it's easy for me to love those who love me. It's easy. Do not even the Gentiles do the same, said Jesus. It's easy for me to operate in a warm and comfortable setting. I love it. Put on a little extra sweater if it's chilly at the edges and go and sit in a comfortable chair. I must take seriously the things I fear about this parable. I hate it, but I must take seriously its teaching. That brings us to Ezekiel. Ezekiel's name means God makes strong. It's always important to know the meaning of a biblical name. God makes strong is his name. He was both a priest and a very eccentric visionary, and he lived in a time of military defeat and cultural deportation. Ahead looked pretty grim. More desolation, more discrimination, and more turbulent uncertainty. More of the powerful grasping for all the gifts that remained at the expense of those beneath them. He sees chaos and abrogation of leadership, and he dares to go after the leaders by name and by role, calling out their complicity and their crimes. Listen to him in his wild eccentricity. "Not for you to gorge yourselves in the sweet grass and drink the cool water, then to muddy them with your feet as the rest of us come along for just a blade here and a sip there. It is not for you to cut the tribe loose and to jump into whatever lifeboats remain and make sure that you and yours make it and the rest of us fail. You do not have a corner office with your name on the door in gold in order to take things from us. You have the privilege of leadership," he says. "This is your moment. It's difficult and demanding, to be sure, but you are refusing the call. If you say, 'Too bad for you, it's only good for me.'" That's tough and daring talk in a time when the culture is falling apart and the powerful are hanging on as best they can. Now, I appreciate what Ezekiel said and did, because I don't want to live in a culture in which I suspect duplicity in my leaders. I don't want to look at life through the filter of false news, no one really seeing what's happening or believing it when they see it. A Republican supporter in the United States on television the other night said, "Even if Jesus Christ came down from the cross and told me that Donald Trump was involved with the Russians, I would have to ask the president first if it were true." That's a long, long way from the world in which I want to live. I don't want to live within the earshot of great promises that never seem to be fulfilled, and instead see a circling of the wagons to win the next election or secure the big deal or to save face or to dodge some legitimate bullet that is coming your way. I want a sense of some genuine humanity in my shepherds, to feel some strength that somebody is going to lead me and the rest of us into places I'm afraid to go. Set me an example and challenge me to go there, I say. Now, Ezekiel, or one of his later editors, we're not sure, goes further and goes to the root of it. And here's God saying, "I myself will be the shepherd. I will remove false leaders. I will heal the wounded. I will carry the young lambs in my arms. And I will send you the model of a good shepherd, what it looks like and sounds like and feels like as it lives among you. You will see it and experience the model of which I speak." And this is the gift of Christmas, the messianic arrival. The model has come in human flesh and in cultural engagement. 50 years after Christ's death, the church gathered together what it felt it understood and saw in his life, 50 years later. And they wrote it in stories, and we read them today as the Gospels. Good news, tear sheets torn off in the midst of a battle that say to us, "Read this and let your hearts be strengthened." What the shepherd looks like moves in the Gospels from anticipation of his arrival to his ascension and the power of a great spirit to lead us where we need to go. A wonderful, remarkable story. A new day is here. You can only see it by looking back, it says. But when you look back, the vision is 2020. Can you see moments in your life when things turn from bad to good just by looking back? You remember the day it arrived, or she entered the room, or the times changed. Can you remember when your life turned? Of course. The birth of Christ is the first part of a four-part quilt. It's stitched into four sections, and the first is arrival. The new day is here. You'll see it when you look back. The second part is called redemption. We awaken to our place in the life of God, and we know we belong there and that we are loved there. Does it not make a profound difference to you in the simplicity of your life to know simply that you are loved? Does that not change everything? Write it large into eternity and realize how profoundly and how eternally you are loved, and see what redemption feels like. The third part of the quilt is empowerment. We are guided by a living spirit, and we know the value and maturity of wisdom and insight as it grows in us. And the fourth section is called destiny. We sense profoundly that we belong to everything now, and we always have. Our essential selves will live forever. We come from a mystery that precedes time, and we will finally dwell in a miracle that exists beyond time. We can face anything in this contemporary life when those things are anchored deep inside. Expectations. What do you expect out of all this living? Is your head swirling? Is your heart hungry at this point? I know that mine is, and this is my own material. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. I expect to experience the touch of the shepherd on my body and my soul at the end of things. I really expect that. The model of Jesus gives me hope. He is for me the good shepherd, the door of the sheep. In him, I go in and out and find pasture. The gift of faith by God's grace has taken root in me. I wait with expectation for Christmas because I believe that in the story of Jesus Christ, the reality of our whole life and destiny is finally told. Ephesians pens it masterfully. Listen. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who's blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. In him we have redemption through his blood, forgiveness of our trespasses according to the riches of his grace that he lavished on us as a plan for the fullness of time to gather up all things in him in heaven and on earth. There it is. Sing me that song, will you? When I finally dare to feed the hungry or give relief to the thirsty. Sing that song to me, will you? When my heart begins to warm to those whom I now fear because of their seeming depravity. Sing that song to me when my will begins to release my love and begins to face the hard realities of our common human life. The letter to the Ephesians, so beautifully written so long ago, has words for us as well, expectations for us. In the midst of a big city, it says, in the midst of an overarching empire, it says, in the harrowing headlines we read, and in this frenetic time of year, there is a deep season in which the true shepherd transforms the world. It is a real season, it is unfolding, expect that, says Ephesians. This is heady stuff. It lifts us beyond all mall walking and Black Fridays and eccentric Mondays and seasonal music heard as wallpaper. It lifts us beyond all that. Let your hearts be light. From now on, all our troubles will be in God's sight.